As those of you who just came from the luncheon, remember Professor Ilvesaker telling us that the delegates here who are and have returned to the place of their good work were not so much coming back here to revise the Alaska Constitution as to revisit themselves. And I'm reminded that it was on a very, very warm late August day in Philadelphia in 1787 that as Benjamin Franklin was leaving that last session where they all had just signed the Constitution, which was to become the Constitution of the United States, he went from that second floor of the old State House there in Philadelphia down to the cobblestone street. And as he entered the street, you can't say a fellow Philadelphian because it was a woman. A woman came up and she said, "Dr. Franklin, what, sir, have you given us, a monarchy or a republic?" And Ben Franklin answered, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." I'm not so certain that the members of this convention, this delegation, revisited or otherwise, do not have in mind looking at how well the document has withstood these few years of government in this part of the world. And I'm reminded, rather, that it was Tom Jefferson who said, "I am not an advocate for frequent changes in laws and constitutions, but laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths discovered, and manners and opinions change, and with the change of circumstances, institutions must advance also to keep pace with the times. For," wrote Jefferson, "we might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him as a boy, as civilized society to remain ever under the regime of their barbarous ancestors." I'm just dropping that so the delegates won't think too much of what they created. We'll hear somewhere at the end of this session another restatement of a symbolic code and the fearlessness of revision. I think we're fortunate, though, to, in another way, compliment the delegates and those who had the idea of this occasion. We're most fortunate that you're here. I recall it was Gifford Pinchot, also known as Professor Herman Slotnick has written about, also known to Alaskan history as one of the great conservators who locked up the resources of Alaska, the coal lands and the oil lands and so on. Pinchot, in his preface to Breaking New Ground, who says that a documentary history must be distrusted, that if all the historians do is look at photographs, most of which are unidentified, and documents, then they will reproduce not a history, but they will produce fiction. And he has made a statement that he believes that the people of their own time must make the first statement of what happened. And I think that each one of us is particularly grateful for the fact that one of your number, Vic Fisher, did complete Alaska's Constitutional Convention with his colleagues, and that Klaus Naske, who was not a delegate, but who was a professor on this campus in the modern time, in current history, an interpretive history of Alaska statehood. And, of course, we remember Ernest Greening's several volumes on this part of history. This might well be the best documented part of Alaskan history, and yet Senator Hensley, I can remember, who is here at this table, mentioned to me once over breakfast that it was terrifying to him when he was in the State Senate and when he was in the House to have to do research with the non-materials of our paper trail of Alaskan history. We have a far course to go. Robert B. Atwood, editor and publisher of the Anchorage Daily Times, I think known to every one of us, was chairman of the Alaska Statehood Committee for a decade. A decade. From 1949 until statehood was achieved in 1959. A native of Chicago, Illinois, Bob earned an A.B. from Clark University, Worcester, Massachusetts, and in later years was awarded an honorary Doctor of Literature from Alaska Methodist University. A former reporter, Robert Atwood became editor and publisher of the Anchorage Daily Times in 1935. Active in many professional and community organizations, Bob is currently a director of the Anchorage Westward Hotel Company. He's the Norwegian consul for Anchorage, a member of the Council of the National Municipal League, which joined with ISEGR or ISER in the publication of this book. He is a member of the Board of Trustees of Allied Daily Newspapers and of Pacific Northwest Newspaper Association, a member of the Board of Governors of the American Polar Society, and on the Board of Advisors of the Geophysical Institute of the University of Alaska. The noted publisher is married to the former Evangeline Rasmussen, an Alaskan writer in her own right, and as you know, they have two daughters. I must warn you that Vic Fisher told me that almost all the titles that you're given for this afternoon's session have been changed, and they have been changed. So please don't expect those titles, but a very lively presentation in still another direction. And Bob Atwood has decided that he would like his address to be entitled, "You Did It." Bob Atwood.
Thank you, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, yes. I don't know how to express my pleasure at being here and being included. It's an honor and a privilege to be invited back to meet with you folks on this occasion. As far as that title's concerned, in all those years we were all working on statehood. Anytime anybody called on Delegate Diamond or me, and later Bob Bartlett, got the same speech. It was the struggle for statehood, no matter what the title was. And now when I find that the title is the struggle for statehood, I didn't think it necessarily had to be that anymore. We all have lived through that, and it ought to be something different. And in approaching this, there's a little degree of disenchantment, because last night I was at a farewell dinner for General Hill, who is transferring out of Alaska, and I discovered, with all his great honors and tremendous record, he's never been awarded the Good Conduct Medal. And now, coming over here today, George Sundberg told me something about this convention that was held 20 years ago, and it's shocking. It seems that when it came to electing a vice chairman, the way the ball bounced, there was no time for any campaigning or anything. They had two candidates. And just as President Egan called for the vote, and it had to be a secret ballot by their rules, Delegate Buckaloo stood up and asked, "How do you spell the name Paratrovich?" Talk about sly deals to swing a vote. As I say, it's an honor to be here, because you folks, you delegates, made a permanent place in the history of Alaska for yourselves when you did this job of writing what we can call the best constitution that's ever been written. And I don't call it a model constitution, because a model is a small reproduction of the real thing. I consider this a real constitution, and it's something to be very much aware of. When that convention convened, the delegates had no good precedents to follow. They had 48 bad precedents, and were very much aware of them, and very few Alaskans wanted much around here from those bad precedents. Making the task more formidable was the fact that, as a territory, we had not been allowed to provide our own leaders. We had limited duties as citizens. Most of our leaders were sent here by the people in Washington, and they were responsible to people of Washington. And rarely did we have a chance to develop whatever leadership talents we had in public affairs. Consequently, the delegates were without presidents and without a stable full of recognized public leaders to look to, and they were something like that grandmother that had to put a bicycle together for her grandson, and she did it, and the grandson asked her, "How did you do it?" And she said, "I just did what the book said." And the boy said, "But grandmother, you can't read." And she said, "I know, but when you can't read, you have to think." And these delegates, in their way, they could read, but they had to think because of all the other things that were lacking in the way of background and traditions. They did, fortunately, have some very good advice from the people, some of whom were introduced to you today, who were very helpful. Now, the document they produced had to be good. They had to come up with a document that would meet a threefold purpose, not one. The Constitution you think of has one purpose as the foundation for government, but this one had three. First of all, it had to be an instrument that would be acceptable to Alaskans, many of whom weren't very sold on statehood at that time. And if there had been many shortcomings in that Constitution, many serious questions about whether it would make a good government for Alaska, it would have been picked up and would have become a big issue on whether Alaskans wanted statehood under this Constitution. And the fact that it was adopted without any question, with no effective opposition, is a testimonial to the good work of the delegates. Secondly, the delegates had to have a document that could be used as a sales tool in Congress to try to sell them the idea that Alaska should be a state. Now, in Congress, there were many members who were not very warm to the idea of making Alaska a state. And it took a lot of sales pitches to them, as we all know. We went back there over and over again, delegations of all combinations of Alaskans, to testify at our own expense, usually. And that constitution that was written here was a sales tool. It did pass all the inspection that the top brains in Washington and everybody in the back rooms and everywhere could give it. And it passed the rules of Congress, it won the votes, and they accepted us and made us a state, which is another tradition, a great achievement, a credit for the delegates. Of course, thirdly, the third purpose and third mission of this convention was to produce a document that would make a good basic foundation for a state government that would be workable. Now, there's no need of my talking about or vouching for the success of that. Every thoughtful Alaskan living here today must realize and recognize the extraordinary achievement of the Constitution. We have lived here under it for 17 years, during which it has been amended only four times. In comparison, during the first 17 years of the U.S. Constitution, it was amended 12 times. Perhaps equally remarkable, in view of the many things we do today, is the fact that the delegates at that convention did their job in 75 days. They set a great example for efficient and effective deliberations. And their example was carried over in the first legislature, which caught the spirit and did their work in 85 days. And just think of what an enormous task they had to do in 85 days to create the superstructure to put onto that foundation. The superstructure consisting of many of the basic laws to govern us, and the three branches of government to administer the laws, and all the details that went into it, the Administrative Procedures Act and so many others. And then, even more remarkable, that same spirit of efficiency prevailed through the second session of the legislature, and it met and adjourned in 65 days, setting an all-time record for brevity. And it wasn't because the load was light. The load was very, very heavy. It's because they tended to business and did it. I can't help mentioning that nowadays, when we send our legislators at Juneau to handle the routine, everyday business of the state, we don't know when they will come home. We're in the position of the parent who used to worry about whether the daughter would get home at a decent hour, but now they worry about whether they're thrilled if she gets home before the weekend's over. Well, the delegates here did their job. They did it well, and they did it efficiently, and they built a sound government. And I think we all know Alaskans are and should be grateful forevermore. Since statehood, good things have happened. They have been beneficial for the people of Alaska. Our lives have been enriched by the new experiences, the new horizons that have come before us. Our opportunities for service and accomplishment have multiplied. Our enjoyment of the good things that abound in our state are increased substantially. But in recent years, something has happened, something that bewilders. Times have become turbulent, sometimes chaotic. We've lost the singleness of purpose that marked so many of our endeavors 20 years ago. Excuse me. Instead, we hear and discern not one voice or signal, but a jim jangle of chords, an a cappella here and a brass band over here, and up in the balcony, a gang with kazoos holding up placards. And our leaders are hard put to it when they listen to this jumble of voices to figure out just what does confront them and what should they do. Their first task is trying to figure out what the reality is, or the multiple realities, so that they can try to make it something manageable. Now, it's easy for our leaders to be misled when they're interpreting what they hear. Something like the foreign spy who reported that Americans were stockpiling for an emergency simply because he didn't understand the concept of Girl Scout cookies. This incessant and dissonant clamor has put strains on the government. Constituencies are fragmented. Organized pressure groups proliferate. There are coalitions of gay groups, black groups, native groups, veteran groups, educators, handicapped faculties, government employees, staff groups, management groups, and so forth ad infinitum. This fragmentation marks the end of community, a sense of shared values and symbols. It marks the end of consensus, an agreement reached despite differences. These groups, many of them, don't want to be in the mainstream. We just want to be us. So with this new form, with this new setup, a new form of politics has come into being. Might call it King Caucus, which has more heads than Cerberus. It's the politics of the multiple advocacies representing people who think they are neglected, excluded, denied, or subordinated. Now, instead of talking about things, we sue. We've become a litigious society. Individuals and groups sue to resolve issues that previously might have been resolved privately. Club owners find themselves sued by their members. College students, when unhappy, turn to the courts. Among the cases pending outside is one brought by a woman who seeks $150 tuition plus cost of her books and legal fees because she was required to take a course that was worthless and she didn't learn anything. A law review has been sued for rejecting an article. And in New Jersey, a federal judge has ordered 28 senators to stand trial for violating the constitutional rights of the 29th senator, a woman, for excluding her from the party caucus. They said, they claim, they did so, they claim, because she was leaking their deliberations to the press. And in Ohio, the Supreme Court has ruled that the secondary school students cannot be suspended for discipline purposes without formal charges and hearings, that the loss of a single day's education is a deprivation of property. Of course, in the area of consumer protection, there's all sorts of new court actions, and the precept seems to have switched from one of caveat emptor to caveat vendor. More and more, the hands of the administration are tied by the real and potential issues, legal issues. Leaders so besieged by these issues lose some of their leadership qualities. They must respond more and more to these external stimuli that divert them from their main task. They become managers instead of the leaders they were intended to be. And we find the judiciary and the executive branches badly in need of help in resolving some of these tumultuous problems that they're carrying right now under our system of government. And the legislative branch seems to be the only agency that has the power to provide that help. These will be some of the areas that will be discussed at these meetings today and tomorrow. And throughout it all, it's certainly with great, each delegate can look with great personal pride on the document that they presented as they review the events that have been shaped by that document since. The Constitution is a firm foundation as it was intended to be. The problems have come from what men and women have built on that foundation and what is in prospect for tomorrow. However we describe the problems, whatever they may be, we can approach them with optimism that proper remedies will be found. We will never allow ourselves to live so buried in contemporary issues that we cannot see and appreciate the beautiful panorama in which they are only shadows. We have proven over and over again the accuracy of the late Senator Clinton P. Anderson's statement when he said, "Adventure has nurtured men of spirit who have built the world for those who lack spirit. In Alaska are men of spirit who stand ready to build a great state." He said it, the Constitutional Convention delegates did it, the executive and judicial and legislative leaders have done it, and we have it. A great state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, your program carries the notice that Professor Rogers, George Rogers, known, I'm sure, to everyone. I'm certain that he's as known to young students here as he's known to legislators through the years and people in Southeast. He lives, as you know, in Juneau on Evergreen Street, but he's all over the state. Unfortunately, he's all over the state, and he's not in Fairbanks today. George Rogers, now this, listen to this one. George Rogers will be unable to attend the Constitutional Review due to the continued airline strike. He's in Seattle in connection with his membership on the Scientific Committee of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, established under the Act extending the United States Economic Zone 200 miles offshore. And he especially wants to send his regrets and his very best regards to the delegates and the staff of the Constitutional Convention with whom he shared those thrilling weeks and months in 1955 and 1956. I believe that it is without error that we can say George Rogers has to be the senior scholar of Alaska for the myriad of works he's put out and his continuing labors on behalf of this state. I do remember when George was out of the state a number of years ago, and he was at the Scott Polar Institute. His family was living there briefly. And it was that time when, within a few months, Martin Luther King and John Kennedy were assassinated. And I remember writing George at that time, and his letter came back, and it was a very, very burdened letter. He said, "Bob, I'm not at all sure. I want to come back to the United States. And I'm not sure but what I've done all I can for Alaska." I'm so happy that he did choose to come back, because Alaska does this to us. We were particularly fortunate, I think. Our forebears and those who were in this land before us, that they had the vision, the members of the Constitutional Convention and the planners of that convention had the vision to bring in expert outside experience. We have lots of jokes about that today, and Professor Ilvesaker did remind us that perhaps we should think more of ourselves making some of these judgments and looking to experience and debate here. But when it comes to building a constitution, then one must look elsewhere. John E. Bevout is considered the top U.S. expert on state constitutions. He was educated at Rutgers, Columbia, and Princeton universities, and he started as an assistant in history and political science at Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's a prolific author dealing with the problems of local government, constitutional revision, urban affairs, and intergovernmental relations. An outstanding consultant through much of his career, John Bevout served constitutional conventions in Alabama, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Hawaii, Texas, South Dakota, Michigan, and many other states, including our own. Bevout is past director of the Urban Studies Center at Rutgers, and he's a consultant to the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, Washington, D.C., and on the advisory board of the Urban Affairs Quarterly in New York. It is impossible to assess the impact which this gentleman has had on the governing documents across America. John Bevout, who is going to speak to us on the Alaska Constitution in the American Constitutional Firmament. John.
Bob, I'm not at all sure that what you said was impossible is impossible. It would be very possible greatly to exaggerate it, but I can say that it would be impossible to assess the impact of Alaska on John Bevout. And for that reason, I am very, very happy to have been called back. This is my fourth visit to Alaska. I hope it is far from my last. I said years ago, and Paul Ilvesaker picked it up, that to have been connected with the Alaska Constitutional Convention in whatever fashion was to have had something akin to a religious experience. And I've come back here partly in hope and the firm expectation of renewing that experience. Now, I don't like to read a paper, and I'm not going to read all of what I'm going to say, but I'm going to stick pretty close to a text for a while because I want to be quite careful about some of the things I say. So, here goes. Every state constitution, for better or worse, is a part of the extended working constitution of the United States, of the whole United States. A state constitution is for the better If, on the whole, it provides the basis for a system of state and local government that is responsible to its people and effective in serving them in such manner that the state plays a positive, creative role in the domestic governance of the nation. It is for the worse to the extent that it impedes such a role by providing for a weak government, slow or inadequate in responding to emerging needs and problems with which the nation must cope. Terry Sanford, former governor of North Carolina, has characterized such constitutions